Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Hey, folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and every Thursday we release these special episodes where we look back at content from the earlier years of the podcast. This week, it's the best of coming-of-age stories, stories from folks' younger years. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Kelly McFarland, but before that, a story from Mara Wilson, the author of Where Am I Now?, True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame. If you recognize her voice, Mara is also a popular audiobook narrator these days. And here she is now with a story we call Eat Shirt.
My father remarried when I was 13 years old. My mother had died when I was 8, and I had spent the previous few years being raised by my brothers. I had 3 older brothers and some babysitters, but mostly my brothers. We called them the boys. And I kind of felt like I was one of the boys. There was never a time in my life from the time that I was 5 to the time that I was 14 that there wasn't at least one teenage boy in the house. So I loved it. I loved, doing all the crazy things they did, setting off fireworks in the backyard and watching movies and TV shows that were way too old for me. And, we would do all kinds of crazy things. We would put our zippers up and down really fast and make it sound like we were DJs. My new stepmother was very much about being proper and being classy. She'd always tell us that you can't buy class, which is ironic because she paid for me to go to charm school. But she was also very, very Catholic. She was so Catholic, she hung the rosary from her dashboard mirror. She would cross herself every time we drove by a church. And we had pictures of the Pope up in our apartments. And she would, give me lectures on virginity. And she was very composed and very quiet. Whereas I was pretty much like the most butch, heterosexual 13-year-old girl that I could be. And I was used to, hand-me-downs for my brothers and going shopping with my dad, who would pull out a pair of jeans and say, "Do you like these?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And he'd say, "Great, buy 7 more and let's go." So she was very much about, jewelry and fashion and not being showy, but being classy about it. And I remember her even saying to me once, because I said, I don't get what the big deal is about jewelry. I'd rather somebody show me that they loved me or care about me through actions, through words, through other things. And she looked at me and laughed. And I said, "Why are you laughing?" And she said, "You're not a girl." Everything changed really quickly, and my father worked a lot, so, my stepmother had a lot of control over the home and over the kids, and all of a sudden, there were all these new rules popping up. Things that I had done previously without complaint suddenly would get me in trouble. All of a sudden, she'd say, "I don't want you on the phone past 9 p.m., or you can't leave the house by yourself, or you're not allowed to use tampons, because I guess she thought they would de-virginize me. I actually ended up hiding tampons in my drawer, like contraband, the way that a more rebellious kid would hide cigarettes or pot. I hid tampons. And I developed even sort of a conditioned response because I never knew when I was going to be in trouble, and the punishments just ranged from all kinds of crazy things. So every time they would call my name, I would jump and think, oh God, what did I do? Did I forget to cover my mouth when I yawned? They were basically in complete control of my life. Fortunately, one of my older brothers moved back in with us at that time. He was older, taking time off of college, and he was involved in this volunteer group he told me not to tell my parents about, because my parents were very, very conservative, and this group was a local progressive sex education outreach group. It was aimed at teenagers, and since I was a teenager, I took an interest. Now, at 14, I was pretty much the biggest virgin in the world. I had never been kissed. I had never masturbated. I wasn't sure if the clitoris was part of a man or woman's anatomy. So the group kind of came in handy. You know, I learned a bit more, and I would dispense sex advice to my friends who actually needed it. And it was nice because my parents trusted my brother, so I had somebody to escape the house with, and I had somebody to vent to. And we had this sort of secret connection that made our bonds stronger. We even had t-shirts from one of the group's events that had the logo on it and one of their mottos, "Safe is sexy." I didn't actually wear the shirt that often. I would wear it as pajamas under a robe or under a sweater and feel thrilled at my secret rebellion whenever I was near my parents. But then one day, after a little hubristic carelessness on my part, my brother knocked on the door while I was getting ready for school and said, "Don't leave your shirt lying around. Dad found it in the laundry room today and he gave me hell." So all that day at school, I was obsessing over what they were going to do to me. Were they never going to let me see my brother again? Were they going to send me off to military school? Or worse, Catholic school? What were they going to do with me? And I realized that the scariest thing of all was that I had no idea. So I told my brother that I didn't want anything else to do with the group, that he could go it alone from then on. I hid it in the back of my drawer, and I thought, okay, I'm safe as long as they don't search my room, and my brother is still here. But then he went back to college, and I had only one thought. I have to get rid of the shirt. I thought about getting rid of it in several ways. I thought about donating it to charity, but then I thought about my stepmother's Catholic charities asking, what is this shirt? Why does it say safe is sexy? I thought about throwing it in the trash, but my parents were the kind of people who kept the key to the front gate locked in their bedroom while they slept at night. And I thought about, you know, giving it to my brother, but I didn't know how. I couldn't see him. I was too afraid to let the shirt see the light of day. So, seeing no other option, one night after my parents went to sleep, I set out to destroy the shirt. I cut off the bottom part and tore it up, and it was just the white parts, and I put it in the rag bucket that my dad used to wash the car. And then I took to destroying the logo. First, I got a bottle of nail polish, and I tried to put nail polish on top of it. But the nail polish was meant to be translucent, so safe is sexy, and the logo were still clearly visible. So then I got out a Sharpie and tried to scribble things out, but the Sharpie wouldn't stick where it had been nail polished. And I had just made more of a mess of it. I eventually gave up on the Sharpie and started to attack the shirt with scissors. By this time, my room smelled of nail polish and Sharpie, and I was starting to feel a little woozy. I took some of the pieces and I ran to the bathroom and I started flushing some pieces down the toilet until I realized that I could clog the toilet this way. And I couldn't imagine what my dad would say if he had to unplug the toilet and safe is sexy came bubbling up out of the toilet at him. I looked at the piece of the shirt and thought, I have to get rid of these somehow. So I did the only other thing that I could think of. I picked up the pieces, put them in my mouth, and started to chew. I used to eat paper as a child, and I figured, well, this can't be much different. But the shirt pieces were tough and coarse and seemed to suck all the moisture out of my mouth. And while paper will actually begin to disintegrate when it's exposed to saliva, cotton will not. It also doesn't taste very good, especially not when it's covered with a layer of Sharpie and nail polish. I chewed as vigorously as I could, but I ended up having to swallow the pieces whole, and I could feel them going all the way down. Afterward, though, I felt this profound sense of relief and accomplishment, like I'd managed to outwit my tyrants. So I went back to bed, but I was soon roused by this terrible pain in my abdomen. The shirt was not done with me yet. It was now engaged in a brutal battle with my stomach and intestines, which were trying to break it down, but the shirt was having none of it. I ran to the bathroom and just lay on the floor for hours, hoping that the pain, as well as the shirt, would pass. And eventually they did, but the whole time I kept thinking, oh God, if I have to go to the hospital and explain this to my parents, I don't even know what I am going to do. And my stomach made these unearthly noises, all with this clear message. Some things are not made to be eaten. So it's about 10 or 11 years later now. I know a little bit more about sex now, but I'm actually kind of glad that I didn't have sex during my teenage years. I think that the way that I handled the shirt and my parents at that age kind of shows that I wasn't really ready to deal with things like an STI or, you know, an unwanted pregnancy. And my parents have mellowed out a lot, too. They have dogs now, and that seemed to have calmed them down. And I think my stepmother and I have realized that while we are very different people, we do have a mutual respect and understanding, and hopefully I think have learned from each other. But there still could be undigested bits of t-shirt in my body. And so I think that it's funny that out of all the punishments that my parents could have given me, or even the ones that I imagined them giving me, I don't think any were ever as bad as what I did to myself that night.
I actually grew up in Maine, and I, my freshman year in high school, I decided to take a CPR class, and it was mostly because my friends were taking the class. Like, I had no interest in learning CPR, but all my friends were taking it, and important things to you your freshman year are pretty much like, I just wanted my look to be really classic and my hair to be big. Those were important things to me, and all of my friends were going to take the class, so I took the class too. And the good news is that the class was pass-fail. So I wasn't the best student, so my chances were really good that I was going to pass. And you can barely pass, and with pass-fail, no one knows the difference. You either pass or you fail. So I was really excited about it. And it wasn't a horrible class. It was kind of fun. There was a routine that we got to do, and they pulled out a fake dummy, Resuscitation Annie. Does anybody remember her? She's this dummy with no arms or legs and a big, like, slight smile on her plastic face, and you would practice the CPR on the dummy. And the instructor was really cheeky. They would put t-shirts on the dummy. Like, 1 week it would be like a classic Coke t-shirt. Like, the next week, it would be, like, our school mascot. And then a frequent t-shirt was this Don't Worry, Be Happy t-shirt with, like, a big smiley face with the dreadlocks. Do you remember that t-shirt? On the dead Resuscitation Annie doll. Don't Worry, Be Happy. And we would practice just for hours and hours on the Resuscitation doll, just practicing. And the instructor made it fun because she said that if you do CPR correctly, it's to the song Staying Alive. Has anybody? Staying Alive, Staying Alive. So it was fun. We would sing it out loud. So it was fun. I was catchy, and I was getting really good at CPR on the fake dead person, and I was really felt good about it. It was a good way to, like, wind up my freshman year. Stellar ending. Summer came. I was really excited about that. And my family, growing up in Maine, we camped in the summer. That's what we did. We seasonally camped, which is not something a lot of people know about. It's basically you find a campground you really like and you set up shop near the lake. It's like our version of summer home. Summer homeless. So we had a lake house, lake homeless. And we would camp there every weekend, and it was like we had a summer place, but we didn't, and we would go to this campground every single weekend, and it was fun. My relatives also camped there, so, which now that I'm saying it out loud sounds like we had, like, a weird commune thing. It wasn't. It was just camping, and there was a very, very sunny Saturday, and we were at the campsite, and we were preparing for a party, and we were really excited about the party. I remember it was a really warm day, and it was my cousin's birthday, and we were really excited because we always celebrated his birthday at the campground, and we were decorating the picnic table and the awnings, the screen tent, which is just a tent that you can see through. It keeps... fancy, the dining room, if you will, and it kept the mosquitoes out, which was nice. And my Aunt Millie, his mother, was making a cake, and she made the best cakes. It was a bear-shaped cake, chocolate cake with chocolate frosting, and like gumdrop eyes, and like little gumdrop buttons, like he was wearing a suit. and then a big like cherry red licorice smile. Like wicked happy. Chocolate on chocolate bear cake. It looked amazing. I was like, that was a fucking delicious cake right there. I'm excited about it. And I was watching her frost it, and everybody was hanging out, and my dad was firing up the grill, and we saw this woman coming up from the lake. And as she got close to our campsite, we noticed that she was stopping at every campsite, very frantic, like stopping. And in my mind, I always go to food, so I was like, I wonder if she's out of hamburger rolls. And she must be out of hamburger buns. This is horrible. Someone should go to town. And so she's stopping at every campsite, and then finally she was coming towards our campsite, and she was very upset, and I was screaming, does anyone know CPR? Does anyone know CPR? Anyone? And my mother went, she does, and pointed at me, who was propped up on a stool licking a beater. Like, I was like, yum, 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 what? Me? And I said, oh, I don't, I was pass fail. Pass fail. And my mother's like, you can do this. You passed it. And I was like, oh did I? But it's not something you can say no to. Like, if someone comes up and says, we need someone who knows CPR, you can't be like, well, if you don't find anyone else, you come on back around. I'm gonna finish licking these spatulas, and then you can't find anyone. It's not like that. It's not like, hey, can you house sit my cat? No, like, clearly this is like, it's time sensitive. So she does. I'm like, I know. And she grabs me by the arm and leads me down to the lake. And the whole walk down, I'm like, what? What is happening? I'm very nervous. I don't think I remember anything. Can't remember anything. I'm drawing a blank. And my dad was trailing behind. And he was like, are you okay? And I was like, what? No, I am not okay. We don't even know what's going on. And the woman starts to debrief us. And she says, someone found a man floating upside down on a blow up raft. And they pulled him from the lake, and he's not breathing. So in my mind, I thought, well, maybe by the time we get down there, he will be up and walking around. Like, maybe he was sleeping. And when I get down there, we'll have a good laugh about this and get to have some ice cream. And that wasn't the case. We got to the beach. And they had pulled him from the water and laid him on his back. And he was on a very bright, very cheerful beach towel. It was a very bright colored beach towel with like these cartoon dolphins that were smiling. And he was laid out on his back. He was wearing orange and yellow swim trunks. Pretty fashionable for a man of his age. I would have guessed he was in his late 60s. He was ginormous, just enormous. I'm 5 feet tall. It looked like I was going to have to climb up on him to do CPR. He had a giant bloated beer gut and very hairy chest, like more hair than I was 14, more hair than I'd ever seen in my entire life. And it grew up over his shoulders like moss on a building and came down his arms. He had a full mustache, that if he wasn't wet or in the water for several hours, would have been like full and fluffy. But instead, it was matted to his face. He looked like a giant walrus on his back. And I looked at him and tried to look like I was assessing the situation. Like I just walked on a crime scene. I was like, yes, I see it. I know exactly what to do. And in real life, my stomach was flipping like over and over. And I'm getting that that saliva buildup in your mouth that you get when you feel like you're going to be sick. And all you want to do is hover over a toilet because that's going to help to just relieve you. But I'm thinking, don't throw up. There's a lot of people around. And you want to make sure that you focus. So as I approached him, I kneeled down. And a woman, much older than I was, touched me on the arm and said, I'm going to help you. I will do the breaths. And I was like, thank Jesus. Because I had never even kissed a boy, never mind a boy with a big full mustache. So I was like, sounds good to me. And we had heard about two-person CPR in CPR class, but it's very outdated, and it wasn't really something that they approve of now, whoever they are. And but I was like, I am willing to take the help. So she did everything normal. She tilted the head back. She did the shake. In my mind, it went, Annie, Annie, are you okay? I don't think his name was Annie. I'm guessing his name wasn't Annie, but Annie, Annie, are you okay? I was like, that's right. And then I was like, staying alive, staying alive. And I got ready to do my part, which is the compressions. So I clasped my hands together, and I had him on his chest ready to go. And I was thinking, I really wish he had on that t-shirt that Annie used to wear, because now I can feel how cold and hard his flesh is. Like frozen solid is what it felt like. And it was my turn, so I began to do the compressions. And just like they had warned me in CPR class, I felt the ribs break underneath my hands. Just repeatedly breaking and cracking. And Annie also had a rib breaking noise, but it was just a pleasant click. Click, click, click. This was more of like I could feel them all breaking underneath my hands. And he wasn't coming to. He wasn't reviving. People were watching. They were very hopeful. And I just kind of went into a daze and just kept doing the CPR. I don't know how long it went on, but it was long enough for me to be scarred for life. Because when the ambulance got there, they quickly shoved us out of the way. And I noticed no one was saying anything to us. No one thanked us. No one said, wow, thank you for doing everything you could for my father or my brother. It was very, very weird. Like, no one was claiming him. Like, he had just wandered down there or floated from a campsite across the lake and then flipped. It was very strange. And I watched the EMTs. They were with him for just a few moments, and they picked him up and then zipped him up in a bag. And it was done, like a package. And they put him in the back of the ambulance and drove away. And we walked back to the campsite, and we didn't say a word. We didn't speak. And I said to my father, I'm going to stop by the community bathroom. I feel like I need a moment. And I stopped, and I washed my hands for like a good 15 minutes. And like washed my hands, like all the way up to the elbow, scrubbing with very hot water. Collected myself. I didn't shed a single tear. Just didn't even have it in me. That feeling of exhaustion when you can't even pull an emotion. I didn't have one. And I knew that he was gone. I knew he was dead, but I didn't really understand if he died before I got there or after I got there. All I know is I just had my hands on a dead person, a dead stranger, for like the last however many minutes it was. When I arrived at the campsite, I thought that I was going to be welcomed back as somewhat of a hero, a brave, brave little biscuit. And when I walked up, the response I got was, oh, Kelly's back. And as soon as that happened, my aunt emerged from the camper with a bear cake on fire. And they sang, happy birthday to you, to which I joined in. Happy, what the fuck is going on? Happy birthday. I ate four hot dogs, four, not light or reduced fat, like genuine, real red snappers you can only get in Maine. I then proceeded to eat cake like it was my job. And no one questioned it. No one criticized. And we didn't say a word about anything that had happened. No one spoke about it. Nowadays, if a kid went through something like that, they would be in therapy like the next day. They'd make them draw their feelings. Show me on the wall where he touched you. Like it would be... Nothing. I didn't get any of that. Nothing. It was just normal, like a normal day, like something that just happened, and we all just kind of moved on. To this day, we've never spoken about it. But what I can tell you is this. This experience has made me realize that there's nothing I can't overcome with a delicious piece of chocolate-on-chocolate bear cake. Thank you.
Risk. This is the Beatles behind me now with one of my favorite songs of all time. And we just heard from Kelly McFarland a story that she first shared on the show in 2013. It's a story we call Where the Walrus Touched Me. Well, that is all of this edition of the Best of Coming of Age Stories. And if you have a story of something that really sticks out in your memory from your younger days, pitch us at risk-show.com/submissions. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.